Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 43. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Liquid Drum. Liquid Drum is all about percussion and community. They're a small organization spreading big ideas through drums, percussion, and music in general, whether through performing, teaching, or simple sharing. Liquid Drum values the communal aspects of creating music and having a good time while you're doing it. You can find them on the web at liquiddrum.com or check out their extensive percussion video library on YouTube and Vimeo. I also exclusively play steel drums made and built and tuned by Kyle Dunleavy. You can check out Kyle's pans at dunleavypans.com. That's D-U-N-L-E-A-V-Y pans.com. And finally, this episode is especially brought to you by Small World Coffee, located in Princeton, New Jersey. If you're ever going through there, stop in. They got two locations, Nassau Street and Witherspoon Street. You don't live in Princeton? Well, you know what? They're online, too. Go to smallworldcoffee.com, and you can buy as much as you want. They'll ship it right to you. Whatever you want, they'll ship it to you. And if you walk in one of their two store locations and you tell them that you heard about them on this podcast, I'll bet you they'll give you an extra punch on your punch card, get you a little closer to that free coffee. They're nice people, and it's a small world, my friends. And when you find some folks who treat you nice, it is wise to treat them back. So find a friend that you owe a coffee and take them to Small World Coffee. Check them out online, smallworldcoffee.com. All right, this episode is with two good friends and collaborators, Ed Fitzgerald, who is a stage manager and Wikipedia expert. And collaborator on this project, Radicals in Miniature, that was written by Ain Gordon, who is another collaborator and friend of mine that's worked with So Percussion on several projects, Where We Live and A Gun Show, and is in this piece that we're doing called Radicals in Miniature. Ed, to be clear, is a hero among mortals. You wouldn't know it by watching him on stage because he sort of does everything very quietly with very little frills. There's nothing, he doesn't do anything extra than he needs to. And I'm not saying that sounds like it's not really a backhanded compliment, even though it sounds that, sounds like that. Ed does his job, and I am constantly blown away by how much he does and is willing to do and take on, and then just execute consistently every night. And he's a really nice guy, a good hang, super smart, very well read, and pretty much can talk to you about anything. All right, I hope you enjoy this podcast. Ain Gordon and Ed Fitzgerald. All right, enjoy. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Theater talk.
Theater talk.
And now defunct show.
And now we could do NPR.
James Lipton.
Hello. NPR.
Welcome to James.
Welcome
Behind
to
Theater.
What bug would you be if you were a bug?
If you...
Totally those questions.
And now...
What's one thing about you no one knows that you wish they did? I got a little slit in your shorts. Showing some leg today, girl.
These are mixed martial arts shorts, so I can do roundhouse kicks.
It's a slut martial arts.
Slut
shorts.
Martial arts. All right. You guys can hear yourselves okay? Is it too loud?
It's fine.
Nope. Feeling great? All right. Ed Fitzgerald.
Yes.
And Ain Gordon.
Yes.
Welcome. Ain, this is your second time on this illustrious podcast. How has it been dealing with your fame since the first one?
It's always good to be asked back. The crowds are adoring. It feels good.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, good. Good. Well, Ed,
Yes. You
are sort of the... you have four lines, but you sort of the silent force behind this show that we are touring this week and next week called Radicals in Miniature.
Indeed.
And I would love for you to tell people a little bit about yourself and where you're from and what got you into what... Like, what do you do?
Well, I'm a stage manager. I have been a stage manager professionally since 19. It was my first professional job. And I'm north of 60 now, so been a while. But I started in high school because, as I mentioned to you last night, I performed in the high school plays and musicals. And a play came around that there wasn't really a part that I was suited for. What? There was a part, but it was a small part. It was Sound of Music, and I played Rolf Gruber. and so the head of the drama department said, "Well, you'll be our stage manager as well." And I really got into it.
In addition to being in the play?
Yes, it did both, yeah. And I really got into it. I made charts over the scene changes, and I drilled the crew, and, mm-hmm. you know, I did all that stuff. So that sort of got me started. And then he got me my first job in summer stock, non-equity summer stock.
Where'd you go to high school?
Irvington, New York. In Westchester. Mm-hmm. So I've been stage managing pretty much ever since. I've done some production managing, and I did a lot of sound early on in the old days when stage managers did sound because there weren't sound people per se. Mm-hmm. But mostly I've been stage managing. And I had a great deal of luck, great deal of fortune in that I moved to New York, and I immediately got a job off Broadway. Mm-hmm. And the second season I was in that theater, one of the shows I did moved to Broadway, and I moved with it. Mm-hmm. And so I did. Then I took it on a national tour, and then came back and started working in off Broadway, mm-hmm. mostly at Manhattan Theater Club. And so the career moved along nicely. I did a few more Broadway things. And then I met the Gordons.
And it was downhill.
It was downhill all the way. And my career took a left-hand turn.
What did, early on in your, like, as a kid, like, what got you, did you, you just bump into theater in high school? Or was there, what'd your mom and dad do?
No, my mother is a homemaker. My father worked at a tool and die place until he became a firefighter later in, until he retired. But I was one of those kids who would put on shows for my family. Mm-hmm. You know, I put on a Stan Freberg album and mime to it, you know, with my sister, you know, she would be my foil as I mimed to her. So I did that three or four times or maybe more, I don't know. So I had a little bit of showbiz in me from the beginning. And then, you know, I was forcibly put into the choir in junior high school when they tested my voice and they realized I could carry a tune. And that led to being in the musicals, in the plays. Okay. So, but there was no background in theater or arts or anything like that. Otherwise, no one else in my family does anything remotely like that.
Yeah. When you met, what were the circumstances around meeting Ain and the company, Pickup Performance Company?
Right.
When did that start? How long has that been?
The first thing I did for Pickup was in 1990 when David Gordon did, he had a production called The Mysteries and What's So Funny, which was about many things, but it was about Duchamp and had music by Philip Glass. And it had been done in workshop in various places, but I picked it up when it did a national tour. For some reason, the person who had stage managed before couldn't do it. And actually, then they went to someone else, and he couldn't do it. And he recommended me. I knew him from working at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where I was an associate production manager assistant production manager for a while. And then I had an interview with David Gordon and Jed Wheeler, the producer, and they hired me. And then they hired me again, and then they hired me again. And I think the first time with Ain was Family Business, which was a show that you and David wrote together, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So we did that.
Yes, it should be made clear that Ed was David's first.
David's
my dad.
First what?
He belonged to David first.
Got it, okay.
And David would like it made clear that he still belongs to David first.
Instead of you.
Yes, okay. That I am renting his stage manager.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the attitude, yeah.
Can you talk, the Family Business is a show that's come up several times just in hanging out, and you sort of allude to it, and you've talked about a lot of the making a show with your family. And talk to me like I'm two about what the Gordon, like what your dad did and does. And I feel like people talk about him as being an innovator at, and your mom too, but at a time in dance and choreography and things like that in theater that he just was doing things that not many people were doing. And can you talk a little bit about the history of that?
I'll try and encapsulate that
the best you can without breaking into
anxiety. Neither a scholar, and I have also a sort of personal fisheye lens view of it all, but I think he was part of something called the Judson dance movement, which grew out of the Judson church in the early 60s, and is kind of credited by most people, the majority of people, with being the sort of harbinger of postmodern dance and the birth of that movement and many of its most important authors were in that collective and in those performances, and then went on to have their own careers, and he was one of them, along with others like Lucinda Childs and Trisha Brown and Steve Paxton and Simone Forti and others. There are more.
Many others.
So that's the sort of first fame, I guess. Not at the time, later. And then he was interested in text, in movement, always. And to him, they were just not separable. And he made dances that talked always. And he is sometimes credited with having kind of introduced what became very popular, which was dancers talking in dancing. And that is, he's either should be credited or should be blamed for that.
Credit goes to the first, blame goes to the second, third, and fourth. Yeah.
So he is that person. So he has made dance and theater and dance theater and theater dance and any mixes of that ever since, with the balance of whether it's more text or more movement switching over time, back and forth over time. And The Mysteries was a piece that was primarily text-based with movement inside of it, but it was really a text-based.
Had primarily actors in it, not dancers.
Yeah. The Family Business, so I was always making text-based work. I was never dabbling in movement, other than people have said that my staging is very choreographed, but that's a different use of the word. Mm-hmm. But The Family Business occurred started out in 1993, maybe. We had never collaborated, my father and my mother, Valda Setterfield, had collaborated many, many, many times. She had been in the Merce Cunningham Dance Company for years and then left that company, and various and sundry things had happened, and she and my dad started to actively collaborate, which they had done a little bit in the early 60s and then not for a long time. And so that was a thing in place. I had never worked, I had used my mother in one of my earlier shows. So we had worked together once, never worked with my dad, really. And then the short version of the story is my father had a housebound great aunt who we both kind of took care of. He went off to Los Angeles to teach for 6 months, I think 6 months, and she fell down and fractured her hip and various and sundry other things, and I found her and took her to the hospital, and 1 week later, my grandmother, her sister, her closest friend, went to visit the headstone of my grandfather, who had died 1 year earlier, and in Jewland, you unveil the headstone a year later, and you go see it. She went to see it in the rain, caught pneumonia, supposedly, and died within 24 hours. And so I got this message that she had died, and that I needed to go tell the aunt that her sister had died. This is her other sisters saying this to me at the funeral of my grandmother. And I said, you know her. She's your sister. You tell her that your sister died. No, you see her, they said. So I went to the hospital and told her. And she said that my grandmother had been the co-signer on everything of hers, the checking accounts, Medicare, Medicaid, everything. So she said, you need to go and take her off everything and put yourself on. So I did, and essentially I then ran her life for 6 months, except in the process of running her life, I had no life at all. I had less and less life every day. You know, I realized that she didn't eat the lunch in the hospital because the cover of the tray was too heavy and nobody would take it off. So I would show up every day at lunch like, hi, I was just in the neighborhood. Oh, what do you have? Let's eat that. So she became my entire life, and I was kind of going insane. And it was also during a period in my early career, I'd had a kind of string of good luck, and then I'd had a show that everybody hated. So I was also like, didn't have any work. And I began to write down our conversations out of self-defense. And then I began to write them down with little changes, like it would be better if she'd said this. Mm-hmm. And then I began to make things up. And at some point, my dad finally came home, and I got asked to do a reading at the Poetry Project for their gala, their yearly gala. And I didn't have anything except these anti-Pauli writings. And but I was very glad to get a phone call because it had been a long time since I'd gotten one. So I said to my father, you know, it's the Poetry Project. There's not going to be anybody there. There's never anybody there. It's going to be in that small room at the back of St. Mark's Church. You know her. You be her. I'll be me. We'll read this checkbook scene. I'll come over like an hour before. We'll read it through once. And then, you know, we'll go do it. He said, okay. So I came over and we did that. And we walked over there, and it was in the main sanctuary, and there were 300 people there, and Allen Ginsberg was right before us. And I was horrified, because I sort of really felt like, oh, people have brought actual art, and we are going to do, like, the Sunshine Boys, and this is going to be really embarrassing.
And yeah, it should be clear that it sounds the whole story sounds very heavy from your description. You broke her hip. She did. Someone died. And so that it's really an extremely funny piece. It's a comedy.
Yes, a lot of it is. And so the checkbook scene, what became to be called the checkbook scene, which is what we read there. You know, we got up there to read it, and we had to yell into the mics because the laughter was so loud. Like you could not. It was like a rock concert. Mm-hmm. And we finished, and we both walked out with my then-boyfriend onto the street, and we sort of looked at each other and said, what the fuck was that? Like, what just happened? I don't know what that was. And my dad said, so, like, how many people are in this show? Because you always make shows with so many people. I said, well, I think there's really only three. It's kind of me and her and all the doctors and all the nurses who are just one person. And he said, well, we know three people. And that is how we got to have a collaboration. And indeed, my dad played my aunt, or the character based on my aunt. Mm-hmm. I played myself and my dad and my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And my mother played all the doctors and all the nurses. And it was a great success. And we did it a lot of times in a lot of places until I couldn't stand to do it anymore and said, no, no more. I don't want to do it anymore. And we fought like cats and dogs all the way through.
I think I should make it clear that in conversations off mic, Ayn, you're always very clear that you love and care for your parents, mm-hmm. and you. I know the behind the scenes stuff that you do for them, and so it's obvious that you would take a bullet for them and you love them. But working with your parents, and I'm sure they would probably say something similar too, like working with your son. I mean, that's the reason people don't shit where you eat, you know, like that's complicated. What was that? And Ed from
a mother saying to the stage manager, would you tell him not to move then because I can't do my thing I have to do if he moves then? Not talking directly to
talking to you.
Yeah, talking to me so that I would pass the message
I'm on. Standing right there.
And so that's sort of what it was like.
We were only speaking to each other often through Ed and a guy named Chuck Finlan, who was the assistant director. And the third time we did it, I insisted that we have a, quote, acting coach who we referred to as Switzerland. And we would all fly to Switzerland twice a week for the meetings with the acting coach to say, like, I'm having a hard time with this scene because Valda seems to need to do X, Y, and Z. And the acting coach would kind of
massage the.
Good Lord. It was not the smoothest thing backstage.
No. And eight shows a week for, you know, weeks on end.
Yeah.
And is there documentation of this show?
Yeah, there's a video of it.
There's a video of an early incarnation, at the first incarnation, well, the kind of the second. There was a half of it premiered at Serious Fun at Lincoln Center, and then the whole thing premiered at Dance Theater Workshop, and that video exists. I don't believe there's a video of any of the subsequent. And actually, the last production, in a way, was, I think, the best.
Mm-hmm. The Mark Taper form.
The Mark Taper, because it was on a thrust, and we really had to, like... The thing about a thrust stage...
What is a thrust? I know what a thrust rake stage is.
Is where the audience is on three sides.
Oh, got it. Okay.
So not all the way around, which would be audience and around. So there's... On a thrust stage, somebody's always behind you. And you really have to... You have to kind of make... You have to give a kind of a bigger performance because somebody's always watching your back. And... The thing about the thrusts, I think, for all of us is we found, you know, eight shows a week, it was a hard show. It was a tiring show. You know, no scene was longer than, like, 12 lines, and all the scenery was on wheels, and we were moving it all.
I think I saw a little clip of it a long time ago when we started working together for the first time, and all I remember is you, like, pulling... huge racks around on stage with curtains and shit and
while just talking,
running as fast as you can.
While talking, a mile a minute,
Clothing racks with
shower
curtains on it of different color for different scenes.
So it was a really exhausting show. So the thing about the thrust is eight shows a week, you would get out there. On a proscenium or in a regular theater, you could kind of come out and be like, well, how does it feel today? How are they? How am I? You could spend 5 minutes doing that. On a thrust stage, it's just like, you better come in at top level. Come in at 10. You just have to come in at 10, which was actually easier. Like, no matter how tired you were, you're just like, 10, here we go.
Yeah.
So.
What, how do you see your role as a stage manager in that, I mean, that was the first production you'd ever done with him?
That was the first that I was involved sort of from almost the inception. So I did the earlier production where I picked it up. It had already been formed. It was a finished thing. But it was also an early production. So my involvement in any sense, except as a stage manager, was fairly limited, whereas as the years have gone by, and I've been with David for a long time, or with Ayn for a little less time, I feel I can have some input. I can say, you know, this thing you said, you took out, I really like that, and he will, you know, Ayn will consider that, or David and I sometimes in rehearsal will look at each other and have the same thought at the same time. You know, this prop will work really good here. And I'd go down to our basement storage space and pull out the prop and bring it up, and we'd use it. So that would, but that developed over the course. I worked with David since 1990, so it's a long time.
I think that started in Family Business because you were a peacekeeper to some extent.
Right.
But also the show, everything in the show, these shower curtains, the racks, everything was crap. It was the kind of crap that was in her house. So it wouldn't, and none of it was stage made. We just bought crap at 99 cent stores. And so it would fall apart all the time. And we were also kind of into, like, just tape it back together, because that's what she would do. So just tape that torn curtain. Who cares? And Ed really became, Ed and Chuck, you know, you could count on them to be like, I taped that tissue box back together. Is this okay? Without you asking. That, and so there began to be a kind of, he knew what the aesthetic was, and you could trust him to maintain it.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a situation, and it's still the case now, where there's not a lot of support beyond the stage manager. There's maybe for a particular production, there might be a lighting person and maybe a sound or a video person or whatever. But that's pretty much it. So in terms of being in rehearsal, it's pretty much only me, maybe a production assistant occasionally. And that gives some freedom to feel like that I'm part of the of the production, of the creation of the production, which I enjoy. It's the reason why I did not continue being a production manager when I had the chance to do that, which is sort of one level up, more institutional and less involved with the building of the piece. And I just I just didn't feel in any way fulfilled. Not that I'm a terribly creative person, but at least I get some sort of input.
I feel like the word stage manager is not, at least in the capacity in which I've known you, I've worked with other stage managers on other projects, and you kind of hoodwinked me a little bit into expecting out of other folks, either a level of input. I don't think those two words
are a level of interest.
Level of it. I mean, rather, yeah, than just being like, I'm here to, make sure the
right
whatever, more task based. I feel like you have.
Yeah, in general, a stage manager would be that. I mean, in most productions, the majority of productions, theatrical productions, the stage manager is at rehearsal to make sure things get started on time and end on time and you do what you wanted to do and the props mm-hmm. are available and so forth. And then when you start running the show or teching the show, he's in the booth calling cues to the sound operator, light operator, and so forth. The difference with Ain and with David's productions is that I'm often on the stage, and either doing many of those things myself or calling the cues over a headset on the stage, and then I will get up from where I am on the stage and get up and move scenery and move props to go. And this is probably the epitome of that. This piece we're doing now, mm-hmm. Where I'm in a visually an equal part on the stage. You're on stage left and I'm on mm-hmm. stage right, and Ain's in the middle for the most part, and I'm doing light. I'm actually physically pushing the light cue button and running sound cues and holding up props and running slides. All things that I'm
speaking
mm-hmm. all things that I might have done as a stage manager off stage in the booth or off stage mm-hmm. in other productions, but I'm doing it in front of an audience now, and that makes it different. That makes it very different.
Are there other shows where there is somebody who plays that role in such a thorough way that you play in Radicals in Miniature? Is that a relatively new concept? It is to me, but it doesn't seem like rocket science to have to. Like, it's like, oh, well, that's. Of course, that could be a thing.
But. I don't think it's new in terms of like the millenniums, sure. But, but I mean, I think it's been going on and off since the 60s that mm-hmm. there was such an idea.
Conceptually, also, if you go back to our town, there's a character called the stage manager. The difference being that it's an actor playing the stage manager, which is different from having the actual stage manager doing what the stage manager does. When we were in New Haven, I had a lady come up to me and say, "So, are you really the stage manager?" And I was like, "Yeah. I mean, there's no one else behind the scenes. It's me."
There's no one in the lighting booth.
No.
But I would say, like, people like Worcester Group, I think, has done this kind of thing before.
But it has to be part of that aesthetic. You wouldn't just throw a stage manager on stage in a straight play or in most Broadway productions. Although I think possibly Bob Fosse's Danson may have done something on that sort.
Was it the real person? Is always
I don't know. I don't know.
You know, like Ivo van Hove. There are definitely people who play these games. I don't know that they are always, and have been, I think, since the 60s. I'm not sure how often it is really, truly, really the stage manager really doing all of the jobs of the stage manager. Yeah. But techies on stage or stagehands on stage.
Yeah.
Also, Japanese theater.
Like Kabuki theater. I know that there's people moving sets around all
exactly.
the time.
So it's somewhat the same concept. But yes, putting... The Brechtian thing of showing all the sinews of the piece and not hiding it is part of the same aesthetic. It just takes it a little farther. But to have like the light board operator and the sound operator all sitting on the stage, but in general sort of in the background,
But it's a very postmodern, in general, in theater and dance, the sort of like show everything that's making the magic and see if you can still make some magic.
Right.
That's a thing.
Why did you decide to go that route with this show in particular?
Really, because I didn't want to be alone on stage and I didn't want to do a one-man show. Mm-hmm. So those were some big guiding principles mm-hmm. from the get-go when I approached you and then when I thought of putting him on. And then even when I approached you, I was like, well, it could look a little bit too much like me and backup, even though you have a whole story that's yours, but they don't know that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I would like to diffuse that some more. And then I would just, to be perfectly candid, because I haven't performed in a show of mine since The Family Business, mm-hmm. I performed in other things, I felt a little, I was definitely had some discomfort about the, or fear around the idea of like, it's me all the time. And I was just like, I felt like the model of what I wanted, which I think we talked about musically too. I was like, I feel like what I want to be like is when you go to the Blue Note and you see some chanteuse who talks, who does patter between songs at will, and kind of everybody holds down the fort while that's happening. And I was like, but this will just be the show where it's all the patter and we never get to the song. So I wanted the whole band on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think in the final part of the piece where we mm-hmm. come together, I think the script says they come closer, a band.
Yeah.
They're a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ed, what is your process like? What is your process like getting ready for a show like this? I think you have a very good way, it feels to me on my side of the stage, of hiding the frenetic drama that's happening in your side of the stage. I think it only ever reared its ugly head once at the end of a show.
Yes, something I like to live
Let's not memorialize that. We're not going
to
tell you.
No, we're not going to. We're not going to tell that story unless you want.
No, no.
But you do a remarkable job of being very calm with the million things you have going on. Can you describe your process on the day of a show and how you synthesize everything you
right,
get
well,
to
it's,
do?
Right. Well, I'm doing this kind of dual thing, you know, the sort of stage managerial stuff and to some extent a performance. I like to keep busy at the beginning, you know, checking things and if I'm not being busy, just hanging out in the dressing room and talking to you guys, you know, and that's, mm-hmm. which is fine. But before that, it's the real prep is, you know, sitting at my station and just checking everything to make sure it's in the right place. Mm-hmm. Because if I go to reach for something and it's not there, I don't have any time to find out where it is.
Right. But just to be clear, for those of you who have not seen the show, he's sitting at a desk on stage, which has the lighting console on it, a sound MIDI board.
MIDI console.
The trigger for all the projections, and also a sweater he has to pick up and show, a coat he has to pick up and show, flour, cigarette,
shoes,
scissors. Shoes, yeah. Yellow legal pad,
tax returns,
yellow letter size pad, tax returns, a blue notebook, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which all have to be picked up on exact cues and lowered at a kabuki pace. So that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, so all that stuff needs to be where it has to be for me to reach for it and get it. Because there's very few times in the play, in the piece, where I can think ahead. I really have to read the script, follow my notes, and if my notes aren't as they were and weren't in some earlier versions, if they weren't quite up to snuff, I would have to think about it, and that would sort of put me a little behind. And the funny thing is, if I start to think about it, that's actually a problem, because mm-hmm. then I will maybe miss something mm-hmm. that I should have just been reading my script, looking at the colored stuff for the yellow ones, which are the slides, and the red ones, which are the sound for Josh's piece, the music for Josh's piece, or my handwritten notes, which are the picking up of the various props. So that's the real prep for me mm-hmm. personally. That's the real prep, that and then making sure in general the whole stage is set. And I'm very fortunate in that Ayn knows where everything's supposed to go, and he's my backup. He's the one that when I miss something, he goes, is that supposed to be there? Oh,
this
no.
is 3 inches to the left of where it always is.
No, I think I'll fix that.
Well, the script being on stage is something too that I feel like I'm a terrible memorizer with music. I'm sure it's a muscle I need to practice more, but
what Josh is referring to is that everybody has their scripts in front of them on music stands or on their table or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is something I think for for a piece, especially with script or words, generally is, I feel like the instinct is to frown upon that. Why are you okay with that at least with this project, why are you okay with that being on stage?
I cannot claim any high-minded reason for that.
Okay.
In this case. It really was a method for controlling my fear about essentially helming a show that I'm performing, that I wrote, that I'm directing, and just feeling like I think I deserve anything on stage that will make me calmer while I'm doing this. And one of those things is the script. Not so much because I needed it, although in the very first production, it was good to have it there because there'd be a few times, not so much by now. But also because it just, for me, which is entirely not true for the audience, but for me, it was like it just takes it down a notch in terms of its showness and made it a little less formal. And that mythology helped me be calm for opening night.
I think that when you talk about the difference between a play and a piece, like a piece to me would have music on stage. You know, we perform pieces all the time with music on stage, and a script is just music, is just word music. Mm-hmm. So if a play, on the other hand, like What So's Done Gun Show or Where We Live, we don't have music stands with our, right, you know, our pieces on it. So there is I think I'll start calling it a piece now rather than a play because of that distinction makes more sense to me, that it feels more like we're performing a set of pieces that, you know, have some wiggle room and some nuance you can highlight night to night.
I did also feel that I was definitely using, because the band metaphor was important to me and the sort of nightclub metaphor was important to me, and there were things about the, like, it's just like come see so-and-so doing their one-man show, and they talk about, they sing a couple of songs and they tell you some stories, and it's like that's the perimeter I want to be inside of. And they always have their goddamn stuff on stage, and they're either paying attention to it or they're not paying attention to it.
Right.
And also the last time I had performed between The Family Business and this, the last big time performing was in this anthology of Spalding Gray's writing. Spalding Gray always performed with his script on stage, whether or not he paid any attention to it. And we always consequently had our scripts on stage in the same mode that he had. So for me, it was a way I was comfortable talking at length. And Family Business was all memorized. We didn't do that because we literally couldn't. We thought we were going to do that.
You were running around.
There's no way you could have done that.
We thought we were going to do that, and then I was like, I cannot run around with a shower curtain while holding a script. That ain't going to work. So,
but you know, in many of the pieces where David Gordon, your father, did have dancers talking, he would have them hold the pages and talk. And even if they had memorized it and knew what they were going to say, he wanted those to see them holding the script.
It's a postmodern.
It's a postmodern.
Is it real? Isn't real? What's real? Blah 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 thing.
And of course, Estelle Parsons, well-known actress, saw that and said, "David, can they memorize their lines?" Yeah.
And no. I think you could do a play with the pages on stage. I mean, a play to me, that wouldn't make it not a play. It would make you playing games with how much the illusion is being created, and that's really the game. That game was there for me too in this, because I there are numbers of lines I deliver as if like, oh, I just thought of this, but the script is right here. So,
The script in a play, I think, I don't feel like the script in this particular piece feels, I'm getting better at it now. This particular piece feels like a prop. Mm-hmm. Like it's not something that we ever address. It's just there. Everything else on stage, from the book to the suitcase to everything, or the coat, everything else is talked about or pointed to or held up. The script is just, it's an aid. It's a tool.
He does refer to it at one time at the very end. He says, I've now done this, and he runs his hand over the script to her. So at that very end, he's encapsulating the piece in the script, which is before him. But otherwise, you're right. We don't draw attention to the fact that the script is there. It's just there.
That's a funny moment, because we've never discussed this, but it used to be in the early rehearsals, I would gesture to the stage when I said that. And I saw on Josh's face a look of like, what's that mean? And I was like, oh, maybe that's not clear enough. How about the script?
Which is very
I don't remember making that face, but I do. It is a, like a last admittance of like an act of aggression or something. It feels like you're copping to when you do something to somebody, it totally. Means without permission.
Right.
And she couldn't give it because she's dead. And yeah, that's an interesting thing to point out. What, Ed, I have a bunch of students all the time who are coming up and they, you know, they think they want to do one thing and they study with us for a long time, maybe at SOCI or something. And then, and they get far along in their studies, but they're afraid to say that they actually really enjoy arts admin, or they enjoy like the thing that people think you shouldn't be striving to enjoy.
Right.
Like, I think the thought of like, well, why wouldn't you want to be on stage? Why you love organizing props? That's totally insane. You love making sure that the actors know what's going on. What advice would you have for students who are in college right now who are sort of, I love theater and they're dealing with all of these issues now.
Well, specifically in terms of stage management, it's changed almost completely since I came up. I did not study stage management per se in college. In fact, the limited amount of time I spent in college, it was I was supposedly heading toward a directing career. And stage managing, which is something I did. I had done it, and I continued to do it. But there weren't a lot of stage management programs at that time. Now there are many stage management programs. And so I'm not able to judge how good they are or how valuable they are to people coming up. The thing I would say is, you know, it's in many ways, this is a different situation working with Ain, working with David, working with some of the other artists that I've been privileged to work with. Otherwise, stage management can be a really crap job. It can be really terrible. You have to deal with so much bullshit from so many people and deal with a lot of details. And in some respects, a stage manager is one of the few people on a production, especially like a big production, who actually contacts everybody connected with the production on the administrative side, the producing side, performance, design, and so forth. And that means you're moving a lot of information. And
you're sort of at the tip of the bottleneck.
You are. It's all coming to you. Stuff happens in rehearsal. You have to take it and make sure the proper person gets that information, or they're not going to know. And then when they don't know, that's your fault. That's not their fault. That's not the person who gave you the information's fault. So it makes you responsible for a lot of stuff. And so my point being, if you don't think you're going to enjoy it, if you don't have like you say, if you don't enjoy organizing and moving information and so forth, don't do it, because it will have very little rewards for you. You know, if you're doing it as a substitute for something else, that's just not going to work. You know, and then you should also, you know, judge, as I did, what level you want to be. Many of the skills that a stage manager has are very transferable to being production manager. As I said, higher up on the institutional ladder. But except you don't get involved with the production, which also means you don't have to deal with so many irascible people as actors and directors and designers tend to be, artists tend to be. And so if that's your thing, if you can't deal with that, well, be a production manager. You know, you'll do basically kind of the same thing. But
Ed, I also just... not related to stage music at all. I feel like you fancy yourself an avid reader editor of Wikipedia.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your interest in Wikipedia?
I spend too damn much time editing Wikipedia. And it's an addiction. You know, I've tried to quit several times. You know, I've had enough of this, because like any situation involving a lot of people with opinions, it can get frustrating. And I was, that's it. I'm done. I've retired. I put a little retired thing on my page and go away. And 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, I'm back again doing it again. I just can't stop.
Why do you feel it's important to edit Wikipedia?
In general, I just like transferring information that I've gotten from books that I read. Or you're not supposed to put in things that you just know from your own knowledge, but most of the things I have of my own knowledge. I read somewhere so I could go back and get the source and put it in. I like to improve the articles that way. But right now, in particular, there's a very strong wave of far right wing editors trying to skew Wikipedia articles to soften the alt-right, the far-right, neo-Nazis, the Klan, all those things. Mm. And they're prolific. It's not a, I don't believe it's a organized campaign. It's just people who, you know, feel this way and say, oh, this is wrong. This is what it really is. And I feel I've added a lot of those articles to my, what we call a watch list, to just sort of keep an eye on and get that stuff out of there. Make sure it's fact-based. What we say is supported by citations from reliable sources, mm-hmm. and it's not just someone's opinion that, for instance, this is a comes up all the time, that the Nazism, that the Nazis were far left and not far right. That comes up all the time. It's a talking point.
As a way of...
Yes,
labeling the left.
It's
here
a way to keep the far right a little cleaner, a little mm-hmm. less, you know, sullied by the Nazi heritage. Mm-hmm. It comes up all the time. It's not supported by any reliable sources at yeah. all, and we have to get rid of it. You know, because it's just not true. In Wikipedia, truth is actually not the bottom line. Verifiability is the bottom line. If you think something is the case, go do some research. Find a source that says that. It has to be a reliable source. It has to be a magazine, newspaper, journal, a credible source that has a reputation for fact-checking and just doesn't repeat things. It can't be a blog. It can't be someone's YouTube channel or something like that. It has to have it has to be reliable. That's what we call it, a reliable source. Make sure you've got that, and then you could put it in the article. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a question, as there was just before I came over today.
On what?
It was about conspiracy theory. The lead sentence of it says that a conspiracy theory is the belief in blah, 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 without credible evidence. And someone wanted to remove the without credible evidence. So there's a little argument going on about can we find sourcing to keep that in, that it's that you need without credible evidence. And I don't want to get into the details of it, but the editor who's objecting, I think, is misunderstanding the difference between a conspiracy mm-hmm. and a conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. The way we use conspiracy theory now is not mm-hmm. the same thing. And, you know, a couple of prosecutors sitting around uncovering evidence of a real conspiracy, a RICO investigation or something, that's mm-hmm. not a conspiracy theory.
Right.
It's the, you know, it's that we never landed on the moon or...
The flat earthers.
Right. The flat earth and right. all that stuff. Right. Anyway, so that's it. I just like to keep the facts straight. I like to keep the articles up to date. I like to pass on the information. I'm a know-it-all, so, you know, I like to let other people know that I know it all.
Is there an area of Wikipedia or a subject that you tend to focus? I mean, you mentioned, like, far-right.
Yeah, I do a lot of far-right. But... I do films, because I'm a big fan of Turner Classic Movies, and I will, if I see a movie that I don't know, and I will then take a look at the Wikipedia article and see what it says and think, oh, I can update this. I can, you know, expand it. And I'll go to some of my usual sources for movie information. To a certain extent, theater, but I don't do a lot of theater stuff, is another one. But then I have a whole range of things, some things about science. Mm-hmm. I think there's an argument going on about blobfish right now.
Blobfish?
Yeah, it's a kind of a fish that looks like a blob. So it's a wide range of things. I think I have something on the order of 4,000 articles on my watch list, which means on any given day there'll be about maybe 30 or 40 articles just to look at to check. And that's not even counting, like, if I'm working on a new article or expanding an article.
Are you, like, a verified? Like, do you have to get verified to do this? Or
well, there are levels. If you sign up and you're there for X number of days and an X number of edits, then you become what they call auto-confirmed, and that puts you at one level where you can edit certain articles. And then if you were there for a longer period of time, you're what is called extended confirmed. Mm-hmm. And then I have a number of other flags which are given out by administrators on request. I can move pages, I can rename pages, I can do things like that, which maybe not everyone can do. But I'm not an administrator, I'm just a rank and file editor with a lot of edits.
How does somebody who looks up something on Wikipedia know that what they're seeing is as current and correct?
Current can be a problem because unless it's something which is high profile, which you can be certain that someone has edited because they've seen it on TV, sometimes some articles don't get touched for quite a while. You can always look at the history of the article and see what the last time it was edited. Mm-hmm. They would have the whole history of it. But really, to tell if the information is right, look to see if the statement that you're reading has footnotes after it. If it's got footnotes and you check the footnotes and they're from, Time Magazine or the New York Times or Washington Post or whatever. Or better yet, for scientific articles and scientific journals or whatever, then you can be fairly sure that it's truthful. The thing is also that it's an encyclopedia, so it's inherently conservative in terms of what it accepts as
small c,
as
not
fact, small not c, not big c, small c conservative in that in science, it will report an article on a scientific topic will report what the bulk of scientists believe, which doesn't mean that these other theories of what may be happening aren't mentioned. They will be mentioned, but they won't be given the same weight as the main theory. And then if the scientists change their minds and decide that it happens in science quite often, then the article will change. But it's not our job to promote what is not accepted by the consensus of the community, whatever the community is, scientists, political science people, or whatever. So it is conservative in that way. Wikipedia is not a place to go and spread your favorite theory about something. It's not a place to go. We don't allow what's called original research. It's not a place this is the way things work. Well, do you have a source that says that? Or you just say that? No, that's not going to get in. It's not going to be allowed. If someone checks it, catches it and fixes it, that's the thing. It could be hit or miss. There are millions of Wikipedia editors who have signed up. But in reality, I believe it's somewhere on the order of 100,000 editors who actually are active. Whoever active editors, we have the same problem that every internet site has with trolls and vandalism and so forth, and we have to keep that in check as well. Yeah. We are one of the few internet sites that allow people to edit without signing up for an account. You can just go to Wikipedia, and it will report your IP address for the edit. I happen to disagree with that.
I was going to say, that seems like a...
It is. A lot of that vandalism comes from there, but that's a hot-button issue, and it's something that's decided not by the English Wikipedia, which is what I edit. It's decided by the Wikimedia Foundation, which provides the servers and...
Got it.
And also sets certain basic policies, but then allows the community of each language's Wikipedia to set up their own rules. So, for instance, they have a biography of living persons policy. You can't put defaming information about someone in a biography article. Mm-hmm. And of course, copyright violation is not allowed for because that opens up the foundation to legal liability. So those are carefully regulated, but otherwise each community makes its own rules. So the experience of someone in German Wikipedia, which I think is the second largest after English, will be a little different than my experience in English Wikipedia.
It all seems like the Wild West.
I mean, it is kind of.
Everybody's. I mean, where do you see this trend towards? Like, I mean, there's no gatekeepers anymore, really. I mean, we have the Funkin' Wagnalls, encyclopedia from 1982 in my mom's house.
Right.
Very few people, relative to what Wikipedia has, probably had much input into what went in there.
Right.
With now everybody being able to contribute. Where do you see this in 10 years, and is your instinct that this is a good thing to have so much input on?
Wikipedia has been tremendously successful. I mean, if you Google any particular topic, more often than not, the first page that's going to come up is the Wikipedia page.
Right.
And those are based on usage. That's not Google being, biased toward us, toward Wikipedia. On the other hand, there are inherent weaknesses in the Wikipedia system, some of which come from its kind of libertarian beginnings. It started as a place with kind of no rules, although we do have a rule. It's one of our basic rules. It's called ignore all rules. So if it says if a Wikipedia rule stops you from improving Wikipedia, ignore it. And then there are, of course, arguments about when you do that. Well, who gets to decide that? Yeah. So, but as it's gone along in the last 15, I was thinking about almost 20 years now, it has evolved more of a governance system, mm-hmm. probably to the intense distaste of many of the old-time editors. Mm-hmm. But it is, if you don't have something like that, it is the Wild, Wild West, and it is the what's the quote? The battle of all against all. Oh. Yeah. And you spend all your time fighting instead of improving the encyclopedia.
I mean, do you know for a fact that these alt-right folks who are contributing aren't just bots? I mean, do you know that they're real people?
No, well, you don't always know. Sometimes they could be bots, but they also sometimes go to the talk page and write specific things instead of just changing the article. And many of those articles are protected from editing, that you have to be extended, confirmed to edit them. So a new editor can't just change them. Mm-hmm. So they have to request an edit on the talk page, and then someone will look at it and say, no, we're not changing far right to far left. Go read the archive. This has come up before.
We've dealt with this
one. We're not going to do this again. So I don't know if the Wikipedia model is going to be, the one that takes over. It may end up being a singularity in the internet, as opposed to being what everyone does. But there is problem. There are problems with politicians' offices, or their people rewriting their biographies and so forth. And it's hard to ride herd on all that stuff. I worry about, if I don't, I haven't edited a lot in the last 4 days, and I worry. I worry what's seeping into those articles when I'm not there. Fortunately, there are other people who look at the same articles that I trust will to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And I can look through my watch list and go, I don't even have to look at this one because I know this editor, he's going to have taken out something that was wrong. And I could speed through a little more. But as I said, it's an addiction. Sometimes I'd like to. I'm sure my wife would like me to stop doing it, because my father smoked cigarettes for most of his life, and he was one of those guys who woke up first thing in the morning and lit a cigarette and had a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm kind of like that with Wikipedia. I wake up and I'll turn on the computer and I start looking through my watch list.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's an addiction, man.
Well, you could have worse,
I suppose. There are worse.
Yeah. Well, let me wrap up with one more question for both of you. What is a massive failure that happened in your life that you would never want to repeat, but you're really glad happened?
Oh, really glad. Oh,
I was fine until the last part of the question. I don't remember being really glad for a massive failure.
No.
I can't quite.
I could tell you a massive failure again, but I can't. No. What I think was a massive failure and was psychologically for me a massive failure, but I don't know. Well, maybe. So, okay. So, the last Broadway show I did was The Violet Hour, which Manhattan Theater Club used to open their Broadway theater. And I had worked for them for 25 years on and off doing plays and knew everyone and was very happy they had trusted me to do their Broadway show. But it was kind of a fraught production in many ways. And I don't want to go into details because it involves personalities. Mm-hmm. But I made some what I thought were bad decisions about how to deal with certain situations. And it kind of put me off doing Broadway. And it's the kind of why it's something that I'm glad happened is it encouraged me to look for other things, to do other things. And maybe that's one of the reasons that I've been with the Gordons for all these years and have not really pursued doing that kind of thing. The Broadway is weird. You work your way up the ladder. You work off me. I worked off Broadway and then off Broadway. And as you go up, you get paid much better each time you go up the step. And to a certain extent, you go to Broadway and you do less work. Because you work off Broadway, you're stapling things on.
You're doing everything.
You're taping stuff. You're doing whatever has to be done, and of course you go to Broadway. It's all done by the union people. You can't do any of that shit. But the responsibility gets a lot harder. You have to make decisions about who's going to perform that night. You know, is this person inebriated and maybe they shouldn't go on, or there, I gave you a hint. That's kind of stressful.
Yeah.
And maybe I psychologically decided, I didn't think of this at the time, but looking back, I think maybe I decided I don't want that kind of stress.
If you're going to manage complicated people, you may as well manage complicated people that you know and love and care about.
For no money.
Yeah. Did you think of anything, Ain? I'll tell you one real quick. I mean, mine is a very similar one. I auditioned, growing up in university percussion studios, you're told that, at least in my generation, you were told that you either teach at a university, you get your doctorate and go teach, or you play in an orchestra. And those two were like really the only path. There wasn't hardly any chamber music groups doing anything in the early 2000s, short of Nexus in Canada and a group called Amadinda Percussion Group in Hungary. And there were others, but nobody was really doing it full time. And so I was like, well, I guess I don't want to get my doctorate. I don't have a desire to be in school forever. I guess I'll play in an orchestra. So I learned my excerpts and did a whole thing. And I went to the very first cattle call audition I've ever gone to, and the only one I've ever gone to. And I get in this room, there's 30 other percussionists of wide age ranges. I mean, you know, kids 19, 20 years old like me, and then guys in their 60s, all playing the same excerpt that I'm playing and obsessing about everything. And you get in the room and all of your instruments are lined up and you start on the first excerpt. And for me, it was the xylophone excerpt from Porgy and Bess. I don't know if this is excerpts in the percussion world. I don't know, like for plays, it's like learning
a monologue,
yeah. Except it would be like learning the Great Dictator or whatever, the Charlie Chaplin. Is that the Great Dictator?
Yeah.
Like learning that, except you're going to learn just the punchline and you're going to say the punchline over and over again out of context of everything that led you to the punchline. That's what playing that xylophone excerpt is. It's only like 18 bars of the intro of Porgy and Bess. Mm-hmm. And I went in there and I'm playing it, boom, and I hit the last note, supposed to be a C natural. I hit a B natural, and the conductor and the whoever the the proctor was of the audition. He's like, okay, thank you, next. And I was like, okay, for my next excerpt, I'm going to go play snare drum. And they're like, no, next, you're done. And I said, I was like, in my good ear? What'd you just say? They're like, you're done. And so I picked up my shitty snare drum and walked out. And I sat on this loading dock with, it was painted yellow and it had green paint underneath the yellow. Like, I had such a vivid image in my head. And I just was like, I'm never doing this again. This is horrible. Like, if this is the way to get to the only other job that, short of teaching, then I will play steel drums at bat mitzvahs for the rest of my life, because that's way more enjoyable than this. I don't care how much this pays. So for me, that was like, I threw away most of what I had been told in school at that very moment. And I'd never want to take another audition in my entire life, but I wouldn't be sitting here doing this with you guys had I not had that massive nosedive right into the side of a mountain.
Well, I have to say that I've never been a professional actor. I mean, I've done a few small gigs, but I don't understand how actors do it all the time, how they audition all the time and take that continual rejection, because, you know, it's 95% rejection, mm-hmm. you know, or 99% rejection. I don't think I could do that.
Nor I. I guess my version is... there was a big there were two big projects in a row that happened at big regional theaters, one of which Ed was involved with, and that one involved was the last collaboration with my dad after Family Business, and there was a project after that, and they were both extremely well funded and developed in house, and I really found, although everyone meant extremely well, that mode of developing work did not work for me. I could not actually produce work that, in fact, any of us liked, let alone me, in that environment, even when the scripts that originated the process were something that everybody was interested in. By the time it had been developed, everybody, including me, had lost interest. And that I do not... Even though I think the work that I make in many ways fits best in the theater world than in the performance world, I cannot develop work in the theater world. That it doesn't, what they need and the system that they have in place in terms of dramaturgy, in terms of multiple versions of drafts of the script, and in terms of pitching the story before you've even written the first draft, all those things are not the way that I write productively. So that taught me that I couldn't develop work there.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up. We have a show to do tonight.
We have a show to do, yeah.
And let me just say, it is always a pleasure. I've worked with you a ton already, and it's always a pleasure to work with you. But Ed, I give you a lot of shit.
And not as much as other people do.
And Ayn piles on, but I want you to know that the people I don't give shit to are the people I don't care about. I think that's you are a good man, and you're very good at what you do. And I think anybody wants to know about what you do,
and I have to say that this show with the two of you has every time been a really enjoyable experience. I mean, I enjoy the time on the stage, off the stage. It's just nice.
Well, see, we like each other.
Yeah. We like each other. Well, let's end on this. All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
So long, farewell. Leader saying
goodnight. I hate to go and leave this pretty sight.
So long, farewell, our leader saying adieu.
Adieu, adieu, to you and you and you.
So long, farewell.
I'd like to stay and taste my first champagne.
Yes?
No.
So long, farewell, I'll read his saying goodbye.
I leave and heave a sigh and say goodbye. Goodbye.
Cannot tell a lie.
I flit, I float, I fleetly flee, I fly.
so must I.